relevant to the lawsuit. It's the public policy of this state that public agencies exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. The people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. And there's a statement of our relationship to the government. If you're sovereign, you have your sovereignty, you do not yield it to the government. Okay? Is that clear? Is that clear back there? Is that... I think that's plain tit-tat-toe, I'm not sure.
How did you know?
And I will say this. Uh-huh. If you're not sovereign, somebody owned you. So you better find out who owned you and who's claiming that you're not sovereign.
Well, actually, you don't say directly that you're a sovereign. What you say is you're one of the people. In one paragraph, you say you're one of the people of the state. In another paragraph, you say the people do not yield their sovereignty. Okay? Now, you'll notice something interesting here. In this paragraph, where it says it is the public policy, etc., the last line of that paragraph says California Government Code Section 11120. The thing to notice is that the wording comes from the code, but the authority comes from you. Okay? You are decreeing this code to be the law in this case. There was somebody who was asked one time, he had this done in his case. He was standing in front of the judge, and the judge said, you know, you claim that you're exempt from the codes, and yet you include the codes in your papers. How come? Well, he couldn't answer that question, so he had his $70,000 of bail revoked, and they put him in jail. They subjected him to it. Well, he wasn't that bright. Okay, so that's how he ended up there. But the thing is that that's the answer is that it is only law because I, in my sovereign capacity, have decreed it. And the people, when in sovereign capacity, the people decree the law. That's the essence of sovereignty. And we have a case to show that it's so. And so, in accordance with expectations, a sovereign is expected to decree the law, and I have done so right here. And I have made the wording exactly like this source that you have taken an oath to uphold. So that would be the proper answer to that. Yes?
If I suffer a moment of brain deadness, can I just answer him, sir, I believe my paperwork speaks for itself.
Well, that's not a moment of brain deadness. That's a proper answer. Let's go back to the website. Go to procedure. And under procedure, what do you do when in front of a judge? When you are a plaintiff and one of the people of the United States or a state in a court of record, the judge has no power to make a decision unless you grant it to him. The tribunal, which is you or a jury, is independent of the magistrate, and all judges in California are magistrates. When in court, there's no need to argue your case. All of your arguments should have been made in the preceding paperwork. See, that goes along with, you know, that you put everything into that original complaint. Nothing to talk about, okay? It's all there. The only reason for a court hearing is to give the court an opportunity to ask questions of the litigants to clarify any points. All right, who's the court? Yeah, you and your lawsuit make the court. So you're in court, you're in front of the judge. This judge, now remember, you have to be the plaintiff. You can't be the defendant. You have to be the plaintiff. So you're in court, trying to get your case moving through the system, and the judge asks you questions. Well, for the sake of putting on a good show in my court, I go ahead and answer some questions. But I have a special way of answering, and so which we will get to in a moment. But the thing is that whenever you make a motion to a court and the other person answers, everything you had to say about the subject should be right there in the paper. Somebody makes a motion, A makes a motion, B answers the motion, A replies to the answer. It's just three papers. It's always three papers. The original motion, the answer to the motion, and then the reply to the answer. And so, when you do that, Everything that can be said should have been said in those papers. When you go to a hearing, the only purpose of a hearing, any hearing in court, is to give a court, or in other words, the judge, a chance to clarify a point that he didn't understand. You're there in front of him so he can examine you. If you don't even show up for the hearing, then he'll go with his understanding. Okay? But you've already made your appearance when you filed your papers. So, you don't add anything. Now, a lot of times attorneys will go in and wing it, and they'll add information to it, and the judges do listen to them, partly out of courtesy, partly out of they don't like people representing themselves, and so the judge uses that moment to provide the judge an excuse to not grant you your motion, if that's what it is. But basically, you are in that court only to assist the court in understanding what you have already said. Okay? Now, if you said it clearly enough so that even a dumb ox could understand it, then you don't necessarily have to answer the judge. But here's what you do. Notice this. The only reason for a court hearing is to give the court an opportunity to ask questions of the litigants to clarify any points. Anything you say in court is considered a novation to your papers on file. Your verbal actions override your previous papers. Novation means a new change to whatever you had before. You don't want a novation on your paperwork. So the best way to avoid a novation is don't talk about it. Because the minute you say something to explain that paperwork, you have now cast out your paperwork, and the whatever you say verbally is going to override your paperwork. The judge will take that as your new meaning. And as you know, spoken words somehow magically get misinterpreted or forgotten or whatever. So here's some suggestions for how to conduct a court procedure. First of all, do not verbally discuss anything in court. The judges and attorneys in court are word masters. They are much more practiced at word interpretation and manipulation than you. Anything you say will be held against you and will provide opportunities to nullify your paperwork. The best thing is not to discuss anything. Why? You've discussed it already in your paperwork. That's what one of your papers is called a brief. Another name for a brief is points and authorities. That's where you do your discussion, in the points and authorities in the brief. Okay? Okay. So, when the judge asks you anything about your papers or points, you should only say, I have nothing to say. It's all in my filed papers, Your Honor. That forces the judge to consider your papers rather than what you may say in the hearing. Or even if he didn't read your papers, he can't say you said otherwise. You have not overridden your paper. You say it's all in the paperwork. The paperwork speaks for itself. Speaks for me. Okay, so that's the first thing. Don't discuss anything in court. The discussions have already been made in your paperwork right up front. Second thing, object to anything of which you do not approve that occurs in the courtroom. The judge makes a decision. I object. Okay? The judge asks you a question. I object to the questions. You know, whatever it is, or you have to kind of use your good sense, if you have good sense, use your good sense to kind of work your way through it, because you're not there to argue with the judge. You're there to move the process through. And so you want to be polite, but you also want to be firm. Okay? I've made my arguments. They're all in the paperwork. And I object to being asked questions about it because the paper speaks for itself. It's clear. Okay? Read the paperwork. Okay, so if there's anything that happens in the courtroom, if somebody speaks out of turn, I object. You know, the process is that the moving party speaks first. And so, if you're the moving party, you can simply say, well, I defer to the other side because I have nothing to say. It's all in the paperwork. Okay? So you give up your first turn. So the second guy says whatever he says. If he gets off beam too much, you say, I object. Why do you object? It's not my wish. Okay? But the point is you object. If he should have a right to say anything he wants to say, But if he starts lying or something, or misrepresenting, or mischaracterizing what you said, I would object. That's not what's in the paperwork, in my paperwork. Okay? Or if he says something that misrepresents his own paperwork. Like we had one case where the person had not was buying a car and didn't get the car. Okay? But when the attorneys were in court, the judge asked the attorneys, or he didn't ask, he says, well, it was his impression that the car had been accepted. And the attorneys just stood there silent. They let him go on with his misconception. Well, that's a place where the other side should have objected. No, Your Honor. They're misrepresenting their case to you. That's not the case. Ask them again. Because in their own paperwork, they had admitted that the cars were not delivered. Okay? So, you run into those situations. Anyway, here's a typical conversation between you and the judge. Something happens in the courtroom, whatever it is, and you say, I object. Why do you object? Well, it's not my wish. Okay, you're the plaintiff, see? Your wish is his command. That's how it works. Okay? Judge says, if that's the best you can do, you're overruled. You say, well, for the record, I do object. He says, your objection's noted. You move on. So you get, it should be part of the record. Now, it isn't always part of the record, so you have to sometimes make it part of the record by filing papers. But basically, you just move on. Any hearing I've ever had for myself has never lasted more than 5 minutes, maybe less. Because that's all I do. I'm not there to talk. Okay, all the talking's been done on paper. So you do the objection. It says, what you see there, that's all that is necessary. You then move on to the next item of business. The judge is going to do whatever he chooses. You have not the power to stop him at that time. Not the physical power, okay? Just as you have no power to stop a robber from robbing you. At this point, your only goal is to object for the record. Let him do what he wants. And you don't have to yell and scream or anything else. You just quietly, but you say it so it's heard. I object. Later, after you leave the courtroom, you type and file the court order to vacate or correct the judge's decision. But remember, this can only be done if you are the plaintiff. Can't do this if you're a defendant. One of the people of the jurisdiction in a court of record is what you have to be. And you have not given anyone, including the judge, any permission to do anything in your case. It's very important that you be the plaintiff because a court is defined as the person and suit of the sovereign. So, as long as you're the plaintiff. Now, if you're the defendant, you do a counterclaim. That makes you the counterplaintiff, and they are the counterdefendant. And you specifically challenge jurisdiction. You can have other things in there, too. But the primary thing is challenging the jurisdiction. When you challenge the jurisdiction, everything must stop in their case, and they have to prove their jurisdiction. Failure to do that, well, they're breaking the rules. They're committing a fraud upon the court if they move on without proving their jurisdiction. Okay. If you're a defendant who is the petitioner in a habeas corpus or a plaintiff in a counterclaim, you should repeat to the other court your demand to be released. You're challenging jurisdiction. Because they asserted jurisdiction, you should from time to time remind them of your demand to be immediately released from their custody. They may not do it, but what you're doing is preserving your rights. And you can come back at them later if they continue to break the rules. So right there, that's all there is to a court proceeding. You don't say anything, really. It's all in the paperwork.
The only problem that we're really having is getting transcripts. And one of the things we find out about transcribers is they will edit them to protect judges and other criminal activities from being sued. And I mean, the last transcript we asked for was supposed to be ready October the 5th. Well, we're about a month late, and even though they called and said they were ready, and the parties went down to pick them up, well, they're not ready. How about that? You got to pay for them, and the accused is supposed to be able to get transcripts and all this information. When you're the defendant in their zoo, They're supposed to provide all that stuff for you. Well, you can't even get an accurate record.
Well, the thing is that these guys, when they act the way they do, it's impossible for them to have a clean record. You know, you can always find something to hang them on. So it's nice to have the worst that you heard, but frankly, there's stuff in there, in this particular record we're talking about, we already have it in the transcript. Even though the transcript might have been cleaned up a little bit, we already have it where the judge said to the person, "You're in my jurisdiction whether you like it or not." And then there's another one that says, "There's no need for you to object anymore. It won't do you any good." You know, I mean, that's enough to hang the judges right there. So, huh? Barratry? No. Well, Barratry, first of all, Barratry excludes the attorneys. But Barratry basically means that you're stirring up the pot unnecessarily. And that applies to the litigants, not to the attorneys that represent the litigants. Okay? However, that does not mean we've eliminated sanctions. Attorneys can be sanctioned for their own barratry, even though it doesn't go under the name of barratry.
Well, if you make the rules of the court, why can you not make a rule that you can bring in a certified public recorder?
Okay, the question is that if you make the rules in your court, why can't you make a rule to bring in a certified reporter? Well, first of all, you can bring in a certified reporter even under their rules. That's no problem. Oh, they won't let you? Okay, well then bring it in under your own. That's fine. Then do it. Okay? And if they refuse to, you can find them in contempt of court what business does the judge have making a decision in your court? Okay? He's interfering with the authority of your court. Remember that contempt of court means that the court is taking an action here to prevent or actually to enforce the dignity of the court and the authority of the court. Those are the two key issues for contempt, dignity and authority. So if the court is ordering that this person be in, but remember, that's your court. Now, if they have a hearing in their court, they're entitled to run their court the way they want. But I assure you that in every court, if you look closely at the record, you're going to see they screw up too.
Oh.
And they're arrogant, and their biggest screw-ups, well, I mean, it happens all the time. So you won't have any trouble getting information. They may erase the best of it when you get a transcript, but even if you don't get the best, you get enough to put them in trouble if you really do your work.
Mm-hmm. Dignity and
authority. Okay, so
comment on it. Well, one of the things you can do is tell the recorder that you need that the next morning because you have other obligations to meet.
Well, you can do that. I know there was. Yeah, you can. He says one of the things you can do is tell the reporter that you need the transcript immediately because you're doing whatever you're doing with it. You know, some other excuse. I know one time I had a real good comment from that a judge had made, and I understood that these reporters modify transcripts and so on. So I developed an urgency with the reporter, and I said I really needed this in a hurry. And I said, but there were a couple of points that I wasn't sure of, and I didn't need the whole transcript, so maybe I could get together with you. So I met with her at noon, and she went through the transcript, and I said, yeah, that's it. And now I said, there's another one in there somewhere. And she read through, and yeah, that's it. And what I did is I bracketed what I really wanted. Okay? I said, just give me the transcript from here to there and that'll be fine. Oh, okay. So she thought I was interested in these 2 points, but she gave me the continuous transcript, which amounted to about 3 pages, 2 or 3 pages, okay? Real short and easy for her. So that's a way of doing it. If you know there's something in there and you just ask for the before and the after, and it worked.
Was that an American?
Yeah, it was in America. Yeah, believe it or not. Okay. So, all right, let's, what I covered here in part was the, okay, the law of the case is covered, basically. Okay, now we have this one. All right, this is the case itself. So we're through with that for the moment anyway. Now let's go back to, I think it's the caption. I've only shown you one caption, and that's the caption where we have Anderson as the plaintiff versus all these other people. Okay? So there is, that's how you would structure or caption an original lawsuit. There's also the counterclaim. So in the counterclaim, a counterclaim is actually exactly the same, excepting for a few little adjustments. Yes, sir.
You have all those people listed as defendants.
Yeah.
I assume that they did different things.
Yes.
In your lawsuit, you lump them all together, and
sure.
In your affidavits and statements, you have the verifications of which
right.
Each one of those do, and then it's all
absolutely.
It's a whole big the
yeah.
whole big case.
Yeah, we collected we collected. Affidavits. We did, you know, a number of sources to put it together, and the lawsuit itself is an affidavit because it's verified.
Is there any logic to spreading it out in a, like two or three or four separate lawsuits?
And no, because it was all the same case. I mean, the person was arrested, and here's this chain of events. As
okay.
One person stopped, the next person started up.
Okay, so that was kind of a serial act.
Yes.
Thing. In the case where I'm involved in one where people are doing, involved in a central issue, but kind of independently.
Yeah, well, it may be that even though they're not talking to each other, they're all working toward the same purpose.
Okay.
They're all causing, you know.
And so you still could put that in the same one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because once the final event happens where you lose, they all benefit at the same time from whatever it is that they get out of it. I don't know. Maybe it's emotional satisfaction. But whatever it is, I assume that when they cause trouble, they're getting some sort of excitement or benefit out of it. So you
well,
just,
one is, but the others, you know, agents and vicarious.
Well, you know, whatever, put them all together is if you see a connection. And be sure to show the connection in your writing. Yes, ma'am.
So you can have all the plaintiffs together versus one defendant? Like the reverse of that?
Well, all the plaintiffs together?
Yeah. If we all go for the same thing.
No, I have all the defendants.
No, I'm just doing the reverse. Just in case you have more than one plaintiff, can you put all the name of the plaintiff?
Well, you can sue them all. You can sue them individually. You know, in your counterclaim. If you have many plaintiffs suing you and they're all bunched up as one, you know.
No, I'm trying to, like, I'm the plaintiff with all the plaintiffs joined together suing.
You mean, wait a minute, you're the plaintiff and all the plaintiffs are together? Are you one or are you many?
Many.
Okay, well, yeah, you can have multiple plaintiffs. Sure. Against one defendant or multiple plaintiffs against multiple defendants.
Everybody?
Yeah, there's no restriction on the number.
Okay.
There are some cases that involve tens of thousands of people. You'd be surprised how big some cases get.
Bill, on form, I notice every paragraph you end it with a period. Why aren't you ending it with a semicolon and?
My court. I could care less what they think of my English. And plus, they don't know anyway. They put periods after theirs. So we're on common ground. If you don't want an issue, don't bring it up. You know, I look at their writings, and they put periods at the end of their sentences, so they obviously don't know either. So we're on even ground, and I make the decision. So what's the problem?
All right.
It's my court. Yeah, remember this. A lot of this stuff goes out the window when you realize you're making the decision, and you haven't brought it up, and they don't bring it up either. Okay? Again, if you don't want to argue about a point, don't bring it up. You know, you hear this stuff about, oh, if you have a social security number, you lost your sovereignty. You hear if you got a driver's license, you have no sovereignty. You're under the total thumb of the government. All of you have heard that stuff, haven't you? Well, let me tell you something. I have never, ever had that point brought up in any case I've been on. They don't know it either, if it's true. That's some esoteric stuff. It may be true, but it doesn't happen in this court because they didn't bring it up. And I don't think they would bring it up anyway. Because let's say it is true. Jim, benefit of the doubt. Let's say it's true. Let's say they know it. Which I don't think they do, but let's say they know it. So you go to court, you put periods, you use all caps in your name, you admit you have a social security number and a driver's license. They don't dare bring that up, that you're under the thumb because of that. You know why? Because if that became public knowledge, that would blow the game, wouldn't it? Well, whether it's court of record, they don't even know what court of record is. The point is that if they knew that point, they wouldn't bring it up because they don't want to blow the game. Okay? If they're in a position where you've got a case and they can, through silent application of those rules, they can do it. But if it's your court, you're making the decisions, the only way they're going to make that work is they bring it up. All right? And if they bring it up, the first thing that you're going to say, take off your sovereign hat and put on your plaintiff's hat, okay? And the first thing you're going to say is, I didn't know that. You knew that? At the time I signed the contract for the Social Security number, you knew that I was subjected to that? I didn't know that. But you knew it, didn't you? Yeah. And you knew if I knew it, I wouldn't go into the contract, didn't you? Well, yeah. Okay, well, that's fraud. So your contract's no good anyway.
Next.
Okay, yeah, next point. We'll go through the same conversation with the period at the end of the sentence and so on. All right? So, yes, sir.
In the case of Marcel Mathot in federal court on taxes under discovery, they came out with a full page of all those things that they claimed gave them jurisdiction.
Sure. However, if I'm doing a counterclaim and I don't do discovery and I let it stay under the table and I'm making the judgment, where does that leave them? So I don't worry about those factors. I mean, if they don't bring it up, it means nothing in the court. If they do bring it up, it's obviously fraud that they've committed in the past. Either way, they lose. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know if this makes sense, but I want to ask. In case of the bankruptcy, if the debtor declare one of the collateral is an asset, and the credit...
If the debtor declares what?
One of the assets is on the bankruptcy, and that asset is a collateral for one of the creditor, but the creditor is not named on the bankruptcy. So what should the creditor do in this case?
Well, I know that if a creditor is not named in the bankruptcy, then the debtor is not relieved from the debt. The debt is still there.
But what about the collateral? That the creditor hold the collateral.
Well, if the creditors are holding the collateral, that's against the wishes of the other creditor, right?
The debtor give the collateral to the creditor.
Yeah, and the creditor is holding it. And are you the creditor? In other words, I'm getting lost in which creditor. I think you're talking about two creditors. One that has the collateral and the other one that's somehow taking possession.
Yeah, it's just a different creditor.
Well, now you have a disagreement, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so now you have to sue.
Sue who is suing who?
Well, I would sue the people that are involved. I'd sue the one who was not supposed to give the collateral over, and I would sue the one who took the collateral, the second collateral. Okay? And we'll sort it out in court as to who pays what. But that's how you protect it. You raise these issues, and your key point is you already are entitled to first position on the debt because you filed a UCC-1 or whatever, a lien on it or something, okay?
But the creditor who holding the collateral, does that creditor has to give back the collateral now? Or
well, I just said you sue him, too. I just told you. You sue him also. You sue everybody who's touched it, okay?
So can she file a UCC-1 during the bankruptcy period because you say...
Wait a minute. If it was a collateral, it's not collateral until there's some commitment. Where's the commitment paper? There has to be a UCC-1 already or a contract or something. If you don't file a UCC-1, whoever puts first claim on is the winner. First come, first serve.
Okay.